This is another Australian Baby Boomer podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Australian Baby Boomer podcast. In this series, we talk to baby boomers from all walks of life about their stories and recollections, about issues that are relevant in this so-called third age, and about things that interest them, and we hope, you. In this, we hear from Norm, a retired teacher who spent his childhood in the 1950s in Kew, a small gold mining town on the edge of the desert in Western Australia. As a township, Kew was established in 1893, when an Aboriginal prospector, whose non-Indigenous name was Governor, found a 10-ounce nugget of gold. The first registered claim in the area was by Tom Kew, which was why the town was named Kew. There was a gold rush and the population swelled to 10,000. By the 1950s, the price of gold had dropped and easy gold was harder to find. The resident population at this time was around 400, although it is relevant to note the original Indigenous residents of the area were not counted, an injustice that was not corrected until many years later. Norm recollects a childhood in Kew where small adventures in a mine-pitted landscape were the order of the day. Please join him as he meanders through his colourful childhood, recalling a place in time that has since passed. He begins by telling us a bit about who he is now before reaching back into his childhood memories.
I'm retired. I'm living in Dawesville, Mandurah Estuary. I've been retired for about 5 years now. I was a teacher from the time I left high school to the time I retired. And I taught in different places in Western Australia, mainly in Perth, but I also did a country stint in Kalgoorlie. And married, and I've got 4 children. Currently we have 11 grandchildren, and that's it in a nutshell. Before I went to primary school, I was living on sheep station. My dad was a manager of a sheep station, and this is a place that was about 40 kilometres north of Kew in Western Australia, and it was a sheep station called Carbar Station. Then in primary years, until end of primary school, my family moved into Kew, and then we attended, along with my brother and my sister, we attended Kew Primary School. Well, it's what you would classify as a desert. It's quite dramatic in some respects. It's part of geography of it is it's an old plateau surface, and it's been eroded over a very long period of time, and you find that you've got things called tabletop hills or mesas and also buttes, and there's a lot of dry river beds and creek beds. The Murchison River is the biggest river system, and that runs all the way through Kew and then enters the ocean at Kalbarri on the West Australian coast. Well, in Kew itself, I was sort of thinking about this the other day, that you live a life which is a combination of innocence and ignorance. It's a ignorance of really the rest of the world. Kew's an isolated town, still is reasonably isolated today. It's on the Great Northern Highway, but back then it was an unsealed road, and the passing traffic was not significant. This is long before the mineral boom in Western Australia. Find that you might get 2 or 3 cars passing through in a day. There was actually a railway line which led to Kew, and also further on and terminated at a town called Meekatharra. And one of the highlights, it sort of might sound strange, one of the highlights of living in Kew as a kid was the train would come Friday nights, and so we would all go up to the railway station and just stand there and watching for the locomotive light coming through the dark. And then the first one to see it, it would be like a little competition. It was a sort of stupid but, sort of childish thing that we used to do. Well, a lot of our recreation was making your own fun. There was no sort of provided entertainment. You went off on your bike, for example, and just went out into the bush, and then hopefully, as far as your parents were concerned, found your way back before nightfall. Spent time exploring places such as round abandoned mine shafts and old prospectors' huts that had been sort of abandoned in the desert. And so that was the sort of thing that we did. Looking back on it was probably quite dangerous what we did. Yeah, but we didn't know any better, and so we used to sort of have a lot of fun, and more by good luck than anything else, we survived it. There was a little bit of gold mining. Dad was actually in between managing sheep stations, or pastoral stations. He was involved in mining, so he had a couple of mine shafts where he was working, and they would take crushings, and one of them was apparently was quite good. Back then, miners paid no tax. It was this federal government that purchased all the gold at a set price, and so you didn't have to pay income tax. The government made its money by buying gold at a fixed price, and then it became part of the gold reserves. This is before the gold reserves were abandoned and we went to a floating dollar system.
You're listening to the Australian Baby Boomer Podcast. Retired teacher Norm is talking about his colourful childhood in the historic Western Australian gold mining town of Kew. Norm goes on to record the tricky childhood politics of negotiating life in a time and place where the population was small and purpose-built amenities for children were virtually non-existent.
We were sort of divided into different groups that circulated without... As a kid, you don't really have a knowledge of adults. Adults are there, but they don't really impinge upon your life. You do know certain people, but they're just adults. As a kid, you have a small circle of friends. Well, in a place like Kew, it's a very small circle of friends, and you have people that you other kids that you are very friendly with, and then you've got a sort of a slightly bigger group that you have a passing acquaintance with. And so, I suppose in some ways, it's not like living in a the suburban area in Perth, where you've got a much bigger group of people to sort of decide who's going to be your friend and who's not. So I guess you're forced in a way to make sure that you don't sort of develop any enemies as a kid. Sort of reminds me of those, you know, the Wonder Years and Stand By Me, those movies and stories about life as a child. And Kew was a bit like that. There were kids that you didn't mix with and others that you developed close bonds with. It was pretty close to my brother, because we were sort of not that far apart in age, and so he was younger than me, and I tended to take the lead when it came to things like going out and rabbit trapping, for example. And that was something that we used to do. And fossicking, it's almost a requirement as a country kid to go and fossick. And we would go out to the local rubbish tip and just dig around, come home with all sorts of little bits and pieces of treasure or junk, according to mum, and then they would be around for a couple of days and they'd mysteriously disappear. So that was the end of that particular discovery. There was a thing called a slime dump, which is tailings from a battery, and a battery is where they used to crush rock to extract the gold, and there was a couple of big slime dumps on either side of Kew, and in one in particular, it was a great place to go and dig. Always had to be a bit careful, because one of the things Dad warned us about is that start digging tunnels in that sun, it'll collapse on top of you and kill you. So we sort of, you know, he didn't mince words when it came to sort of telling us what we could and couldn't do. So we had to make sure that we dug with the idea that we weren't going to sort of encapsulate ourselves under a pile of sand. One of the things that we learnt about quite young was cyanide. Cyanide is a chemical which is used to extract gold along with mercury. And cyanide is not a sort of a long-lasting residual thing, but supposedly it is in the slime dumps, and these dumps have perhaps a residual amount of cyanide, but I think over time weathering and rainfall and that leaches it away. So that's something we were sort of aware of, but I guess it couldn't have been that deadly, because I'm still here today. One of the interesting things we did find in them, every now and again we'd be digging, we come across the remains of an old rifle. And so back in those days, the idea of having rifles and shotguns was not an uncommon thing. And I guess these old rifle barrels were probably there from almost the turn of the century, back in the 1900s and that. So, you know, that was part of the buried treasure thing that we sort of spend hours digging and sort of mucking around on these dumps. And so that was an exciting activity, I guess. There was an old guy that Dad used to look after a bit, because at that stage, when we moved into Kew, he'd taken up a shop, and so he was one of the local shopkeepers, and he would take out groceries every week to this old guy that had dug into the side of a hill not far from Kew and turned it into a sort of an underground house, I suppose a bit like Cooper Pedy is in South Australia. And he lived there, and we used to go out there, and strange old guy lived on his own, can't even remember his name, but eventually he couldn't look after himself, and he was moved into Kew, and the council of the shire built these huts called the pensioners' huts, and they were sort of a one-roomed little box with a wood fire inside and a space for a table and a space for a bed. And when I went away to high school, for my first year of high school, I went and boarded in Geraldton, and when I came back, this old guy had been talking to Dad, and he got me round, and he said he'd been studying algebra and he wanted me to teach him algebra. And I had no idea what algebra was, so, you know, I was having trouble with maths too, so, you know, he was there and he's going, you know, well, you know, what does it mean when X, you know, over Y equals Z or something like that? And I'm going, I don't know. I know that they're letters of the alphabet, but I really don't know anything else. So he was getting, not angry with me, but he's sort of quite frustrated the fact that he decided late in life that he wanted to learn algebra. He didn't understand it, and I didn't understand it, so that was a kind of a strange meeting. I've actually been back to Kew a couple of times since then, because my grandfather owned a pastoral station north of Kew, and that was a place called Kolkully. So I went back with my wife and also son-in-law, and we went on to the station, and we went to where his grave was, because they were buried on the station. So there's a small grave site there with three graves there, and that was one of them. Oh, yeah, and the cemetery at Kew, like I said, when I went back there, I've gone in there, and it has a real sort of history. If you're into sort of going into cemeteries, I find them quite interesting, because you find a history, it tells you something about the people of the time. Yeah, cemeteries. When I went into the Kew Cemetery, you see what people have passed away or died from at previous times. And one of the things that they were dying of was typhoid. And in the middle of Kew, there's a rotunda, and there's a water fountain there. And I always wondered why, as a kid, the fountain never worked. And, you know, nobody seemed to know why it never worked. And then I found out later on that it's the actual source of the typhoid. So people were going there and drinking the water, because that was a sort of a public water supply. And then there was a typhoid outbreak in the town, and that was traced back to that. So, you know, you see things like that in the cemetery, people dying of typhoid, people dying of gunshot wounds, people are dying in mines. And it's also kind of sad in a way, because you see, for example, so-and-so of County Cork, Ireland, so you think, you know, these people are a long way from their homeland. Here they are, virtually in the middle of the desert, and this is where they've ended their life. There's one particular one there I found very sad, and that was a young woman and her baby, and based on the time that they both died, it seems that the baby had died first shortly after childbirth, and then the mother had died from complications, and so it was quite a fancy headstone erected by the father or the husband, just to indicate, you know, life in turn of the 19th century wasn't easy for women in these goldfield places. The school was interesting. It was a two-teacher school, grades 1 to 3. You were in one classroom, and then from grades 4 to 7, you were in the second classroom. First classroom was the same teacher, probably since the beginning of time, and Mrs. Armanasco. She was a real character, because she would scold you, and if you were doing something wrong, she would pick up your ruler and she would crack it across your knuckles. And then if she did it hard enough and it broke the ruler, then she would give you a sixpence to go and buy a new ruler. Weird thing, but anyhow, that was how it was in that class, and so you accepted it as being normal. Then we had different teachers in grades 4 to 7. I remember one particular teacher, well, I won't say his name, but He used to quite like using the cane, and he would get you up at the blackboard and ask you to do long division, and then if you were too slow, he had the cane, he'd be sitting there at his desk with his feet up on the desk, and he'd lean across and he'd give you a switch on your backside. In order to avoid that, what I would do is I would keep moving, and for those of you who remember long division the old way, you had to sort of carry down the columns, and every time he hit me on the backside, I would move across one, so I never managed to do the long division. The numbers would always be in the wrong column. Yeah, I don't think that's in any of the teaching method books today, that method of teaching mathematics. But we lived in different sorts of houses, so some of them were quite well built. There was a house that we lived in. Mum and Dad never actually owned any properties, but we always rented, and so we lived in a stone house, which was a very large house. It was used as a lodge, I think, for the Royal Society of Buffaloes or some organisation at some stage. And then behind the shop, the shop fronted onto the main street, and then it was part of a number of shops all sort of up against each other, and then behind was where we lived. We lived in a place which was made entirely out of pressed tin, and I remember that because the walls, the ceiling was covered in pressed leaves and pressed flowers and fleur-de-lis and all sorts of fancy stuff. It was an interesting place, that one, because Father built us a swimming pool. I wouldn't call it a swimming pool, but it was a tank which he'd cut down and put in the backyard, and then filled it with water and put dirt. Now, the dirt around Kew is red. Everything's red. And so you'd jump in there, and then the water would turn slightly brown, and then you'd jump out, and then you'd jump back in, and it'd turn a bit more brown. And so eventually there was about six of us, all the local kids, and then we'd be going round and round this tank making a whirlpool in the middle, and it'd be a sort of a dark brown soup of water. So you managed to get about one or perhaps 2 days out of the water before it had to be drained out. As far as the heat goes, it's something that we didn't really notice. We did go out into the bush at different stages. Sometimes we'd go on a family picnic and end up at a water hole on one of the rivers that flowed through. Now, the rivers, when I say river, I don't mean it's got water in all the time. Most of the time they're dry, but there are sort of certain sections where water collects, and so they form billabongs where there's water during the dry seasons. So as far as weather goes, I do remember one thing about the weather. It doesn't rain very much in the desert, and I remember once when it did rain, and it rained a fair bit, Main Street turned into a river, and it had quite deep gutters on either side, and we would go up to the top end of town and inner tubes, hop on the inner tube, and then these are car tyre tubes, and then we would go down to the bottom and then get out and then go back up to the top and start all over again. So it was our own sort of water park in a way. Happened probably once. Really, there were some things which apparently you could eat, but I found most of it quite bitter. There's these things called cobblers, which type of, I don't know how to describe them. They had a kind of a silky sort of fibre material inside that supposedly you could eat. I do kind of remember eating lizard, which sort of sounds strange, but some of the Aboriginal kids that lived in Kew, we went out one day and hunting, and we got some small lizards, and they made a fire and put it on, and then we cooked these lizards up, poor things really, and then afterwards we ate bits of them. They weren't particularly big, maybe about 5, 6, 7 centimetres long, so there wasn't much meat on them. But most people ate mutton because it was a significant sheep grazing area, so pastoral stations, and so mutton was the most common meat eaten at that stage. Not a lot of steak, and that's the traditional Sunday leg roast, potatoes and cabbage, and perhaps some carrots, and so, you know, what they used to call meat and three veg, standard fare. So things had to be brought in, even fruit had to be brought in, and so it wasn't as though this was something which was grown locally. And no, I don't actually remember ever eating a banana until I came to Perth. It was something that it just didn't travel well, and it was sort of perishable. Things that were perishable kind of didn't make it, so it tended to be fruits that could sort of travel the distance because it was all brought up on the train. It wasn't sort of something which came very quickly. You'd wait perhaps weeks between different supplies. When Mum came down to Perth and took the three kids down to Perth, that was sort of something that evokes a strong memory because of the smell. That was steam trains. Burning coal has a distinctive smell if it's been used in a steam engine, and it's something that you never forget. I remember coming back from Perth once, and we sort of caught the train at night time, and by the morning we were sort of around about Meriden on the way back. I can remember waking up early and just looking out the window and seeing the sun rising over the wheat fields. It was sort of something that stuck in my mind, you know, all these years. Well, it was something that you slept overnight. You get on at night time and you'd sleep during the night, and then probably by the beginning of the night the next day you'd arrive at Kew. So train would come in of a night time. So it was pretty well about a 24-hour journey by train, yeah. Also, another time I went to, the year I went to Geraldton to boarding school, we got on the train, and then sort of a cyclone or a big rain belt came through, and it flooded the railway line from Kew to Geraldton, and it took us a week to get from Kew to Geraldton because we were on the train, and then the train would go out and it'd find that the track was still covered in water, and so it had back, and so we slept, and that was sort of a fun as a kid going to high school year 8, because I arrived there a week late, and I missed their week of school, which was great, and then we each night they would put us up in a hotel somewhere, and so we never ate so well as we did on that week. While you did have some contact, there did seem to be a sort of an invisible barrier between us. We didn't sort of, you know, the white kids tended to hang with the white kids, and the Aboriginal kids tended to hang with the Aboriginal kids. And you did sort of have some interaction and that, but it wasn't a lot. They sort of had their life and we had ours. So even though, you know, we were living in the same place, it wasn't necessarily something where everybody was sort of mixing with each other. There was a couple of kids who were part Aboriginal that used to hang around with. A lot of the Aboriginal kids actually lived out of Kew. They lived on the stations with their families or their sort of family groups. And it was only at the end that they'd actually built a hostel in Kew for the Aboriginal kids to come in and go to primary school. Before that, I don't actually remember that a lot of Aboriginal kids actually being at the primary school, so I'm not too sure where they were actually going to school. Interesting thing about the school is that you didn't progress. They had a system where you didn't progress from one grade to the next unless you considered to have passed that grade. And we had 14 and 15-year-old kids in still doing grade 7. They had these sort of big lumpy kids all sitting at the back of the classroom, and you know, you're 12 years old and they're 15, and there's a big difference at that age.
You're listening to the Australian Baby Boomer podcast. Retired teacher Norm has been talking about his childhood in the gold mining town of Kew in the 1950s. He has been back in recent years and finishes by telling us about what the town is like now and how it has changed.
Well, there's a lot more traffic going through the place now, and it's on its way to other places. And so if you're going to a place like Mount Newman, you're going up in the northern areas where a lot of the mining is. During the peak of a couple of years ago, there was almost a continuous stream of road trains passing through the place, and so that's one of the things where there's been a big change. It's no longer a kind of isolated, seldom visit place that it used to be in my childhood. It's almost an obstruction on the road as all these road trains are passing through. There's been a real attempt by the people of Kew to sort of make improvements to the place, and so the council there has been quite active in getting money to make improvements, things like the caravan park and also doing up some of the older buildings there. Kew apparently used to be called the capital or the queen of the Murchison. It was the largest town at one stage there. It had over 10,000 people living there, and as is usual for towns of that particular era in the sort of 1900s that probably had about a dozen hotels. Still got some of those big old buildings left. They're in a bit of a state of disrepair, and people are trying to do what they can to keep them in reasonable condition. There's been a new building there on the outskirts of the town, which was associated with some gold mining. Most of the mining there now is open cut mining. Back in the 50s, open cuts were not a common thing. A lot of the mining was small scale underground mining. And now I've been back to the places where my dad mined, and they've been turned into massive open cut pits. So getting lower grade gold ore and using large machinery and leaving these huge, what I can call scars on the landscape there. Out of Kew, there was a place I went recently. I don't remember that range of hills, but it wasn't a range of hills at all. It was the dirt from a massive open cut pit that had been turned into a low range. And so that's one of the things, the landscape is been sort of changed forever by the sort of new mining methods. It's probably quieted down a bit, but there is still mining. For example, on the property that my grandfather had, Kolkali Station, they're reworking a place called Reedy's. Apparently Reedy's quite a reasonable sized town back in the day, because this is in the sort of early 50s, and it had an Olympic swimming pool there, and it had a range of shops and that, and that is where Mum and Dad lived when I was born. And then there's another place called Burnakura. And Burnakura was a site where my grandfather originally had a gold mine, and that's how he made his money to be able to purchase the pastoral station. And that's now been turned into a couple of very large open cut mines or open cut pits as well. And then there's another place called Big Bell, which is I think west of Kew, and that's been turned into an even bigger open cut pit. So wherever there was gold, mining companies have gone back there again and worked the same ground to get what was left of the gold. And with those methods, using very large machines and all the rest of it, you can move vast quantities of rock and get lower value gold ore. There are some places where there's some copper and manganese, but that whole area really, the Murchison really is a gold mining area. The Murchison Goldfields, as the name suggests, it's not as significant as the Eastern Goldfields around Kalgoorlie, but it was still a pretty significant gold mining area. And there's probably still gold there to be found. Companies want to spend enough money looking for it.
I hope you've enjoyed hearing Norm's recollections of Kew. The town is a great place to visit if you're heading into the Murchison area. It has a number of attractions worth visiting, from its wonderful historic buildings to its surrounding landscape. The Kew Caravan Park houses the old jail, which was rebuilt to a design provided to the WA Architecture Department in the late 1800s. The town is a good base for exploring other attractions such as the historic old settlements in close proximity. These include Big Bell, Daydawn and the nature reserve at Nallan, and also the ancient rock paintings by Indigenous artists at Walga Rock, about 48 kilometres from Kew. Of particular interest is the suggestion of an early encounter with Europeans in the form of a sailing ship, which is depicted amongst these more traditional paintings. After this episode was recorded, Norm recalled another thing that struck him about the local cemetery. On the edge of the cemetery were two old graves facing in the different direction from the others, and they have headstones with Arabic script. He guesses they might be the graves of two of the early Afghan cameleers and suggested that they could be an area of research interest to someone who can read this writing. So thanks, Norm, for sharing his insights and memories of this pivotal time in his life. And until next time, thank you for listening.